Len Garismo, and the session is Treasures on Earth, Treasures in Heaven. Where does that phrase come from? Treasures on Earth, Treasures in Heaven.
From Matthew, isn't it?
And what is the context?
What? Do not build up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust can erode it, but build up for yourself treasures in heaven where moth and rust cannot get in.
All right. What does that mean?
Where your treasure is, so will your heart be also.
One of Luther's many brilliant insights was his definition of faith for God. God is that to which you give your heart. Right? And if you want to understand whether you have faith or idolatry, where is your heart? It's just brilliant, piercing through of all of the debates about what God is and all of the complications that people put on it. And it's also very practical. It's very useful. It's helpful for us Christians to notice the many times where we stray. You know, where is my heart? And why? And is it some kind of a place where I haven't worked through what I need to work through? Is it a place where Satan has grips on me? Is it a place where I have longings back from that period when my mom was sick and I didn't get what I needed, and so I have this pull that's sort of subconscious that just says I really need this extra bar of chocolate or this product that I saw on television because I somehow buy the notion that that's going to fulfill my life. And if I could just notice and sit, just rest with myself. And one of the exercises I do is to look at the object, you know, this new thing for my computer, and tell myself I'm not going to get it, I'm just going to look at it. And of course that just brings up all of my anxieties about, no, that's not what I want to do. And I'll be able to sort of just rest with it and sort back through and discover the difference between my real needs and my wants, you know, or my passions or desires or perversions or whatever else drives me. And any other thoughts about this treasures on earth, treasures in heaven? Is that a useful way to start? Those of you that have looked at the Give Us This Day booklet, does that make sense as a starting point? Or to put it more bluntly, is our culture one that has problems in this area?
Yeah.
Serious ones?
Questions you want to think of?
How about as a culture? Do we have problems with where we put the vast resources of this country or this world or of a given state in terms of treasures, how we deal with the different levels of treasures in the world?
I don't think, I think we need to, there's more equitable distribution of the rewards for work.
Mm-hmm. Well,
this is, I think, where a nation's treasure is a prosperous nation where all people have received a reward for their contribution. But of course, some work is regarded more valuable than others. It's a matter of what is work and why work. Have you ever read the book by, is it Dorothea Silla?
Silla, yeah.
Why Work?
Yeah.
I'd like to get my hand on that book. I don't know where I can get a hold of it.
And she has another one that I had planned originally to comment on on the Bonhoeffer, On Earth as in Heaven. I'll pass it around. The Liberation Spirituality of Sharing. very, very interesting and provocative book. I want to get down to the second thing you said. You said equity and distribution, and also something about different kinds of work being rewarded differently, or what was the...
The evaluation of a man's work.
Okay. Let's continue in this vein. I think this is a great place to, way to start, and a great place to start. Where are the problems? Where are the issues? What needs fixed? What's broken? Equity and distribution of resources, and the way we value some work vastly and others not so vastly. There are baseball players that make as much in a game as blocks of people, not even one family, whole groups of people make. There's baseball players that make as much per swing as families in our culture.
Heard that it costs $3,000 to pitch a ball in Major League.
why do you blame them when it's one people who buy the tickets?
We're not blaming anybody at this point, or at least I'm not. We're observing. These are sort of symptoms. And like a doctor, you know, you can have a symptom that, you know, you don't blame it. You observe it, and you, in fact, if I get the gist of why you wanted to say something, it would be wrong for us to simply blame those symptoms. Like a doctor isn't going to blame the infection or the fever that you have. In fact, you're lucky that fever told you to do something about something and to discover, do you have a cold, or do you have pneumonia, or do you have a cancer? Right? That fever is not something to blame. It's something to notice, something to evaluate, maybe fix with an aspirin, temporarily, or you know, on a kind of a superficial level, maybe get wheeled into surgery. My father went to the doctor one time and was wheeled into surgery the next, you know, hour later, right? So that's a very useful comment that you've made here to sort of set us straight on what we're doing. where are the problems? What's broken? Where are the symptoms of in this whole issue area that we're talking about here?
It goes back to somewhat supply and demand.
Say a little bit more about that. What do you mean?
The fewer people that can supply something, the more they seem to have a worth.
The more
worth they seem to create by having something that's limited to a few individuals.
Uh-huh.
Now I think there's other people that could perhaps play as good a ball as this person is getting.
Right.
But he hasn't been found. I think a good example is when Chrysler was in such terrible economic. I forget the wizard that brought him out of Chrysler, but he was rewarded with millions of them.
Tens of millions, nearly hundreds of millions. And at the same time, there are probably numerous cases where in daycare centers there are brilliant daycare workers whose skill level is equal to Ken Griffey Jr. or Randy Johnson, or you can see where I live. And yet they will never make even more than the worker with the same number of hours in the next room over. Right? My mother-in-law works in a daycare center, and it's very modest pay if you're trying to raise a family. She's retired.
And I think that follows through into the entertainment world.
Uh-huh.
Most people are, their value has gotten ridiculous.
Right. And it, for a society that lately has been going through a kind of an infatuation with youth and with children and making sure that we give our children the best we can, the Republicans and the Democrats are falling over each other, rushing to the microphone to try to show how their new initiative is going to be better for the nature's children. I mean, it's just ubiquitous in public policy and in newspapers, right? And yet, Not one penny has been added to the salaries of those people, many of whom are brilliant, many of whom are contributing extraordinary skill.
But the one who negotiates his high pay, their skill, is probably getting richer than other people because he is representing Randy Johnson.
Right. What was that movie, Tom Cruise?
Jerry Maguire.
Yeah. Are there other arenas that there are problems in the whole issue of treasures on Earth and how that relates to
the United States using all the... I'm sorry. Well, in the United States, a nation of have and have nots, but then compared to our nation, to other nations, we really have it all.
Right. I've been poor in my life. Many of you have. Not like the people I saw in Mexico City. U.S., I'll put third world in parentheses, or in quotation marks. It's really a two-thirds world, or something. That was not a great
term for it, but it's, we know what it means at least, so.
I don't know that we need to be so self-deprecatory, though. I mean, we look at Europe and they're doing pretty well over there economically too.
It's not Where is
just
that?
Europe. It's not Definitely. Just the United States that's better Very off much. Than the rest of the world. It's right. many other countries too. We don't need to just take the full blame ourselves.
Japan.
No, and again, it comes back to like, what are we doing here? I think one of the skills of this kind of inquiry is withholding judgment until you've got it figured out. And it's very useful to recall that, I mean, there are countries that have higher standards of living than the United States, even by some scales, or more money. There's real, I met a fellow from Argentina, and he shared his disdain or dissatisfaction or disgust or whatever at people just lumping Argentina in with the poorer countries in Latin America. And he showed me a picture of the city he grew up in, and it looked like, you know, Philadelphia. Tall buildings, beautiful houses. As far as the eye could see, there weren't slums right at, you know, 100 yards from the edge of the city. And I mean, there's much that is very similar to our style of life and intellectual and cultural and so forth levels. And, you know, a lot of our stereotypes, well, I'll speak for myself, some of my stereotypes had to go down the tubes, you know, step by step as I meet people that say, no, you don't get this wrong. This isn't it. And that spirit of being open-minded and being willing to be wrong and put it out there, and if it's wrong, change it, not be worried about, you know, how else are we going to learn, you know? One of the best bosses I ever had said, if you're not making at least 3 or 4 mistakes a day, you're not trying hard enough. So don't be afraid to put out your thinking wherever it is, and if by the end you've changed something, you're better off than the guy next to you, not blamed and worse off. So, okay, a couple more people. Did you have something here that you wanted to contribute?
I'm thinking about what the Bible says about money. And of course, Christ himself spoke about it, and the subject of money is, I don't know how many people count how many times it's mentioned in the Bible, several hundred.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And we all know the phrase, you know, for the love of money is a root of all evil, not the root, but uh-huh. the root of all evil.
Uh-huh.
And there is our admonitions throughout Scripture which warn us to be careful about our acquisitive nature and the laying up of goods and treasures to our detriment. And so, you know, Christians have to kind of balance this in some way. And that's the dilemma many times in our lives. You know, many of us in this generation have been blessed with post-war, World War II prosperity. And, you know, we are well off as a result, not a result of inflation and whatnot, but we are in monetary terms, we are much better off than probably our parents.
Oh, yes.
And some of us worry about our children, ever being able to achieve that kind of affluence. But, you know, then becomes the problem, you know, how am I to be a good steward of all this, of these treasures? So I'm not proposing any answers here, but I think some of the answers are in Scripture.
Yes, I would imagine.
They better be there. I know they're there. If we'll heed them.
We also are not very good stewards of our natural resources. We use them as though they're not going to be there for our children and grandchildren. The second lesson of Bethel says to rest till and keep the earth. We don't do that very well.
I mean, there even economists and environmentalists who would vote in favor of the economic side versus environmental debate, you know, in some of the debates in Congress now, are of agreement. The world's resources could not sustain everyone in the world living at the level that we are, just in consumption and use of water and use of natural resources. It's just not possible. It's also not possible to get there immediately, but that, you know, if we believe that everybody in the world ought to have equal access to resources, it can't be at the level that we are. Something would have to change, either new technologies that would allow less resources to be used to develop things that we feel are vital, or reduction of the quantity of the resources. The ozone layer, the oceans, the soil, the pulling of raw materials out. I mean, all of these, there's three different teams of experts here at Holden, employed by three different sources, you know, the mining company, the Forest Service, and a third party. And those sorts of people float in here every week of the year doing research to try to figure out what to do with this gargantuan pile behind me. 85 acres from the air. You could see it from a satellite. It's that big. You know, we benefited a lot from all that copper. Think of all the homes that have wiring because of that mine back there. But we also have to deal with the results. And there are companies that are out of business, don't even exist anymore, who have left behind piles like that. And hundreds, thousands. I mean, the Superfund list is several thousand, isn't it?
But people don't realize that in a mining game, it's only less than 0.1%.
What is that again?
Less than 0.1%
of the use
of our land.
Yeah, it's very small. But the impact can be great. I mean, there are large areas of the earth that would be in real trouble if the cyanide and other very, very hazardous materials that are used in the production of that copper got into the groundwater, for example. I mean, look at Love Canal, just to pick one of many that one could pick. I mean, there are places where there are significant portions of the earth's surface affected by one of those, like 0.1%, whether it's a mine or a factory or whatever. We're at the point where we can't ignore the consequences.
I just went through a situation where I lost my job because of that.
What industry or what area?
Mining.
So you know better than anybody.
They take my job away from, you know, the bureaucrats take my job away from me because they say, well, we're protecting your health. And then they just let it go. Now, you think that's fair? And the company was doing all they could possibly do to meet the environmental constraints. Yet it wasn't enough, because they were going to shut them down anyway. Now, that's gone. Now, that not only happened in my circumstances, but it has happened in every state of the union.
And one could say, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their lives because of hazardous chemicals in workplaces where they weren't shut down. So, I mean, it's both sides.
It's not an either or. We probably are erring on the side of allowing companies to continue simply because the economic benefits in their community are just so strong. And if you would debate me in the United States, and I think I'm right, it's certainly true elsewhere in the world. Go to the same kinds of factories in Mexico or in Russia or Malaysia or whatever, and look at occupational safety. I mean, I worked in a factory for a number of years. I have 10 or 15% of my ability to smell that I used to have. I have almost no use of the mucus glands in my nose, and it was because of annealing plant, or you know, metal fabricating plant that used acids and chemicals and paints and so forth, just never even read the hook on the what kind of safety precautions ought to be taken, what kind of ventilators ought to go in and so forth. And it was years after I left the place that a doctor just did a kind of a history. He says, you know, tell me about this, tell me about that, where did you work, and kind of zeroed in on this particular factory that I worked on for, it worked at for nine months. Not even that. And other people, you know, were coughing and choking and so forth all the time. And I just never occurred to me, maybe this isn't a very good place to work. I needed the money. I needed the job. And that's not uncommon. I mean, it's true that there are some very rigid ways in which environmental safety or other kinds of regulations and standards are put down. I mean, you know, there are, talk to small business people. I mean, there's all kinds of stupid use of rules that, you know, that just drive you crazy. I mean, as the head of a nonprofit organization, I have to deal with some part of those kinds of rules, and they'll drive you nuts. You just want to strangle the next governmental official you see. Real nonviolent sort of person, am I, right? Work for a peace group, you know. But there is another side to it, and I've seen both sides, and you probably have too. You know, more than me. So yeah, please.
It's interesting if you go back a couple hundred years or maybe less that safety conditions and working conditions in this country were very bad, and it was the unions that through their efforts, especially in the mines, to get things safer and safer. And now what has happened is that it is not the union so much, but the government has got into it, and now companies are forced to meet safety standards for their employees. So years ago, where it was, for instance, the union saying you must wear safety shoes, hard hats, we want our employers, our members protected. Today, when you look at it, it's the company management that's saying, you will wear safety shoes, you will wear a hard hat. So what goes around comes around.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. I've been a member of or involved with a half a dozen unions, including the Teamsters, as it happens. And that's one of the most interesting parts of our culture, and it's a casualty of our amnesia, our incapacity to know anything that happened more than 10 years ago or so, that we don't realize all the wonderful things that unions brought, which would help us go after the abuses that unions, you know, engage in. And it seems to me we get the worst of both worlds. We don't appreciate the positive things that unions can bring. Many people don't, I should say. And on the other hand, we don't haven't been able to very effectively aid, like Teamsters, the insurgents, you know, trying to take over the union or take back their union from people that had turned it into something like, you know, part mafia, part club, part union. It's a pitiful kind of a thing. I mean, I saw intimidation of people that I've hardly ever seen in my life, you know, in union. It reminded me of like when I worked in the higher crime areas of New York City, where you'd see people basically shaking other people down, you know, on the street. And, that shouldn't be tolerated. And yet, on the other hand, where would we be without unions? I mean, it's really unbelievable that people could think that unions are fundamentally a bad thing in our society. I don't think that a careful dispassionate reading of history would come up with a totally anti-union result. Because you look at the, just take one industry after another, the needle trades, the steel industry, the rubber industry, the chemical industry, and so forth, and look at where things were before the union came in and where they were after. And then a lot of that has actually been lost in ground. I mean, don't take my word for it. Business Week magazine, not a real sort of liberal kind of left-wing type rag. The current issue, sharing prosperity. Wages are starting to move up, but real wages for more than half of all Americans are actually lower than they were in 1989. What will it take for them to catch up? A year and a half ago. Is America becoming more of a class society? This is Business Week. New data show that increasingly workers at the bottom are staying there. And the charts and graphs in here are what I use anyway to try to talk about sort of where things stand. I'll pass one of each of these around if you're interested in just taking a look at this. And unions is probably one of the more controversial pieces on this. I mean, there are a number of them, like politics, where there is very across the board political agreement that our political process is not only in serious trouble, it's in jeopardy. If it's not already over the edge in being jeopardized by the impact of big money. If you did a graph of inflation or costs in the United States going up, and then did another bar that showed the costs of campaigns, it's like four or five times as steep. Where it used to be you could run for Congress and be in just an ordinary Joe like myself, get a bunch of friends to contribute and come up with $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 and run for Congress and get elected on your merits. Now, it's not one person, one vote, it's really $1, one vote. It's whoever can raise the money for television ads. And if they can raise significantly more, and if they're not a total fool when they get in front of the television camera, and in fact, if you're a total fool, you could even have other people in front of the camera on your ads and get around that. You can get elected. And I'm not exaggerating to say that literally 90 or 95 or 98% of the elections are swayed by those sorts of considerations. I can count on the fingers of one and a half hands the number of campaigns that I know of where the person that spent significantly less money won. And that's not just me, it's just think tanks and academics and researchers across the political spectrum, from ultra-right to conservative to liberal to left, agree and have produced reports that say just that. There was a hand over here.
The church's function in this, isn't it a matter of attaching responsibility and understanding to responsibility for the voting, rather than being mesmerized and hypnotized by the display ads on TV and the glibness of the politicians.
That would be a very useful function of any group, including churches, to play in society. I guess when I think of, we'll talk more tomorrow about the church's role, but just in a nutshell, my view of the church is fairly conservative. I grew up in Missouri Synod. I think that the church has run into problems a number of times that I know of where it attempted to influence or meddle in politics. But the church does have a responsibility as the primary sort of moral agent in society and as a community of people who perceive themselves as following the call of discipleship. Virtually every book in the Bible has something on the order of the reading tonight from Isaiah 58, you know, that to do justice, to love kindness, you know, to seek after righteousness. So that the first function of the church is the source for large communities of people of that public morality. And then a second is the sort of function that's being conducted here. A neutral ground, or as neutral as it can be made, for the formation of values and character. for the interchange of ideas. And you'll guess where I stand on a number of things, or I'll tell you where I stand on things, but I'm one person among many. I mean, and I hope you'll buy it, what I say, to the degree that it makes sense, that you'll scrutinize my thoughts and thinking as well as anybody else's. Ultimately, each of us is responsible for his or her own actions and conscience. So the church, in my experience, is reluctant to take stands on things, but is a place for people to, of varying points of view, hopefully, which doesn't happen so often in the rest of society, to be able to engage these issues. And then finally, there are places where there are clear violations of the commandments of God or of morality, where the church can say with clarity, apartheid really isn't right, or slavery, 100 years ago really isn't right, or the segregated society in the South isn't right, or this particular war does not either meet the standards of a just war, which is the mainstream approach, or violates Christ's commandment not to kill. Different people have different approaches, just to give one example of a place where there are different perspectives within a church. But basically what I see us doing here, just to jump the gun on tomorrow's discussion, is to be a place where we can wrestle with some of these issues. And what this fact sheet attempts to do is begin with a few sort of indisputable statistics, like the one that led our list here, equity and distribution. It's worth noting. We don't yet know what it means totally, or even very much, but it's worth noting that in 1962, the differences in income between the head of a corporation and the average worker was 1 to 12. 20 years ago, it was 1 to 40. Now it's 1 to 90 and rising. Fortune 500 corporations, according to the Wall Street Journal, is 230. That's a huge change and a huge disparity. And in the same period of time, it hasn't gone up in Europe or Japan. It's 1 to 12 yet in Japan, and it's more like 1 to 20 in Germany. Now, these are our principal competitors. So, again, we don't know exactly what that means, but it's worth registering that those numbers are significant. Those numbers are dramatic. And there may be something there that we need to take a look at. Maybe there's something awry. Maybe these are symptoms of a deeper ill. And in fact, that was the conclusion of Business Week, that were basically corporate executives and financial analysts, which is what Business Week is, readership is, among themselves need to be wrestling with these issues just like we are. And they're pretty far along the path of concluding that there is a danger sign in these kinds of figures and statistics.
But wouldn't you want to say, from just an ethical point of view, that it doesn't make that much sense? I mean, Isaiah didn't wait for the Business Week of his day.
No, certainly not. And in fact, it's a little embarrassing if Business Week is ahead of us.
Exactly. So shouldn't we just be asking, what do we need, ask the larger questions of what we need to have peace in our culture, and then say, these things are definitely not being met. Plus, some people are making millions and millions of dollars while others starve. I don't know if it just seems. It is curious to approach it with with equanimity, but on the other hand, it's outrageous. I mean, we could approach
that is my personal opinion as well. As a group leader, I hold back a little bit on my personal opinion, because that's not my only job here, to give my personal opinion. But I am outraged. And in fact, people were talking the other night about Bill Gates' new house finally opened, $60 million, parking for 30 cars, it goes on and on and on. It's just really kind of awesome. And it's that actually doesn't even get to me very much, but there are other kind of features of the sort of incredible consumption at the top that are really kind of scary. My brother is a geographer, for example, and he was a part of or had read a study of ownership of farmland in Vermont, and most of it was owned by doctors and other people with fairly large amounts of money from New York City, and there was something sort of disturbing about that. as someone who owned at that point a farm in Wisconsin, or he and his bank owned a farm in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have huge numbers of farmers who farmed the same land in their family for generations losing their farms because they couldn't make payments, you know, and there have been lots of articles and movies and other kinds of illustrations of that kind of phenomenon. At the same time that you have farming in an entire state being preponderantly either an investment or kind of a plaything by others. I mean, there's something a little awry given food being so central to life and bread being the what we pass at communion. I mean, there's something that sort of touches deep symbols of our faith and deep sources of our whole culture. Again, symptoms that suggest, you know, deeper disturbing illness. Yeah.
I've always wondered why the resources that a human being needs to survive, like water, air, and food, why can somebody own that and then sell that? Now, so far they haven't got a hold of your air, but there are places where you have to pay for a drink of water.
Right. In fact, you can buy air now.
Yeah,
you can buy bottled air from places like Colorado or whatever under the assumption, just like bottled water, that what you can breathe right here just isn't as good as it could be. And
but
so
I don't understand why somebody can own food.
Yeah.
That I've never been able to really understand that, even though I know that farmers do that work and put that out. It used to be that man grew his own food. And I can understand those concepts, but I really don't understand how somebody can own food and keep it.
Right.
A number of years ago, I read this article, there was a member of the Ford family, a young man, very idealistic, had gone to Peru and saw the starving Indians. So with his own money, he went back and he chartered the boat, he got the boat, he got the wheat, he got the grain, he sent it to Peru. But it was it wasn't a good idea to feed those people, because if you fed them, then you couldn't control them. So the stuff laid on the dock and rotted.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's enough food in the world to feed everyone. And what is the figure? 35,000 people die a day from starvation. I mean, that, to echo your comment here, that's an abomination. I mean, a Christian has a real hard time going on business as usual with that kind of statistic.
Look at North Korea, that's a classical example.
Yeah, right.
I'd like to ask a question of our discussion.
Sure.
Maybe I need to be able to express a couple of ideas.
Please.
The one question is, am I hearing an antagonism toward the free enterprise system? In Russia, without it, they failed. And
or was certainly far less successful by most measures, we would agree on.
Yeah. And
not all.
They're having a hard time trying to come out of it.
Right.
Since what they had for a number of years.
Right. It has very few defenders.
And,
you know.
For some reason, and I spent 5 years in Carmel, California, and 2 weeks in Ethiopia a year ago, and I don't think that we can lambast the rich like we poorer people do. But to control the wealth of the world, who's going to be the controller?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the questions is, why is it possible for a culture like Japan to function as, by all appearances, as effectively managing those sorts of things with a 1-to-12 difference between in income? That is, the top managers make 12 times as much as the average worker, and ours is 180. I mean, so the question is precisely not simply like attacking the free enterprise system, but asking, why does one free enterprise system, is it able to do that same function without some of the obvious side effects when you've got these extremes? the sense of the brokenness of the culture, the sense of lack of identification, the sense that someone else is benefiting vastly more than you are, and you're working as hard or maybe harder, or it feels like harder anyway. I think those are the at least on one level, the kinds of questions. On a second level, what I want to do is directly address this question. Is the point here to criticize the free enterprise system, is what I hear your question.
And lambast the rich.
Yeah, or lambast the rich, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's, I mean, I've known rich people that seem to be normal people, have their problems and so forth. I don't know that there's Christ had friends that were rich, and it'd be nice if we did too, you know, or if we don't already. So I don't know if it's, the question is to lambast, in fact, I don't think the question is to lambast the rich, unless there's something else going on, like outrageous greed or whatever. And that would be more kind of on an individual basis, on an individual morality kind of basis. But I think the second thing is to say, if we're talking about like how a society organizes itself, we live in a democracy. We all have an equal vote in how our society gets organized. And if there's some way of improving the way we organize, whether it's government or the parks or the amount of money that we give to one thing versus another, or the way we organize corporations, we have a right to talk about it, and we have a right to change it if we think it ought to be changed. And there are ways that corporations are run that I would propose are healthier than the way many of our corporations are run. For example, in the Pacific Northwest, the plywood industry was largely cooperatively run. There were many, many experiments, maybe not largely, but there were very significant part of the industry was run in a kind of cooperative fashion. So it couldn't happen where someone would just simply be, after 10 or 15 or 20 years of work, be thrown out of their ear and have no say in it. Where these were places where, people had a stake in the enterprise, they could have a say in what happened when prices were putting pressure on the company, and should it go out of business or move elsewhere or change to other product lines or whatever. They would be involved in those decisions. And there are increasing numbers of people, including Business Week, that are saying, maybe that's the place where we need to look at free enterprise. There are other people that are asking whether free enterprise itself has some defects that are more than superficial.
I don't think that it's a perfect system by any means.
Uh-huh. But you would.
But I'd rather be in America than I would in Ethiopia.
I definitely would.
One of the things I found out about the Japanese and the industry,
yeah,
is that they don't allow them to fail, but we're allowed to fail in this country. But the Japanese culture and Japanese industry and government, they're all in bed together, and they will not allow any industry to fail because that means they have to support the workers. So they put tariffs, pretty hard tariffs, on imports to control that.
Yeah, they look at the way they handle trade from a governmental level compared to the United States, and there's some really big differences. You had a comment or question?
Well, I was just going to say that when the woman in the corner was saying about she doesn't understand how food can have commodity value when it's an actual necessity,
right.
Human necessity, how can somebody get money for it? I would say that money is a necessity, and that when somebody has $1 billion, they're holding on to some of my money. They've got some of my money. They've got some of your money. They basically, there's this limited amount of money in the universe. And if they have it all, they better be doing something good with it.
Right. But,
I mean, that's what Reagan said. He said, let's cut back on some of the taxation on capital, what's that thing called? Capital gains, right? So that rich people can get richer because they actually do better things with money than poor people. Poor people spend money on alcohol. Rich people spend money on commodities and building factories and stuff like that. But what rich people spend money on turns out to be yachts and vacations and crazy stuff that degrades the environment. So I would say that we do have a problem there, just that accumulation of capital is not a benefit to the culture. So it seems to me that our regressive tax structure, the fact that we no longer I have the wrong word there, but the fact that we no longer tax rich people as much as we used to means that poor people are not benefiting. Our schools in the inner city are a travesty. They're just a disaster area, and we no longer are giving any consideration to the kinds of needs of our culture, the entirety of our culture. We're rather allowing the rich to take off in that direction. It's something they should take advantage of. I probably would too if I had $1 billion to invest in the stock market. But I should, because that's a waste of my talent as a human being from a Christian point of view.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell only on this question, but I think it's an important enough one, and I think you framed it in a valuable enough way to do it, say at least one, I would say both of you, on this question. And I guess another piece for me, as someone who grew up believing that there were two options, free enterprise and communism, which is even mixing metaphors, that's the political, that would be like comparing democracy and communism or something. But anyway, to leave that aside. And you had to pick one or the other, and that's the end of the discussion. There's no more to say about it. And at the very least, it seems useful to look at things like the General Foods Plan in Topeka, Kansas, that was run by worker control and was more successful than any of their other plants on almost every measure of the running of a business, whether it's absenteeism or productivity or whatever. And it was an embarrassment. And other corporations didn't like the existence of this model side by side with unrestrained capitalism or free enterprise because they wanted it to be run that way. So in other words, it's not simply a question of choosing, of do I support free enterprise or oppose free enterprise. I support freedom, I support democracy. And we have freedom at the upper levels between people that own stock to be able to buy and sell or move resources into different places where they think they can make more money. We do not have freedom for most workers. I mean, part of the deep discontent in this society is that not only blue-collar workers or lower-paid workers, but many, many white-collar workers have deep worry about whether they're going to have a job in a few years and whether their company is going to give a damn at the point where their job might be in jeopardy, or consult them or allow them to have any say in, or involvement in helping come up with a strategy that would allow them to continue to work somewhere. That's one sort of place where I think the whole question of free enterprise, it's not simply which system do you want, and they're not just two options. There may be some ways that we can retain the tremendous strengths of our system, particularly when you compare it to the worst systems in the world, like what was left in Ethiopia after colonialism totally upturned their culture upside down.
Absolutely.
Or North Korea, which is a disaster. Of course, I wouldn't want there to try to grow anything in their climate. Or Russia, you know, which I wish we were putting more resources into making sure that that didn't degenerate into some disaster. There's another, perhaps even more sort of eye-opening kind of consideration. Why is it that the bulk of the experience and the writings of the first couple hundred years of Christianity, that is, the people that were closest to Christ, the people who were influenced by the apostles, by the disciples, by people that had direct connection with Christ, more often than not, had opinions about economics that were along the lines of is it 1 Corinthians? Sharing, holding things in common. Something that had some of the elements of free enterprise, but also had some of the elements of socialism. You can't say that word too loud, socialism, because it's not allowed in a lot of the discussion today.
I can't really hear it if you don't say it loud enough.
Well, yeah, right. I had to repeat it louder just to get it out. Now, and all the church fathers, I mean, I saw a quote the other day from Augustine who said that anybody that has more than they need is stealing from the poor. That was his notion of, he isn't known as a liberal or a socialist or whatever, he's on the conservative end of most of the scales, but I mean, most of the church fathers spoke at one time or another about this. And as you said, I mean, the Bible is rich with insight and information and discussion of economic issues. the word oppression appears 1,000 times or something like that. I think I got the number wrong. I think it's about 600 times in the Bible. There's like 10 major words and about 10 words that are less common. And there are two books out, one by Thomas Hanks and the other by Elsa Tamez, that spend the entire book tracing the notion of oppression. And it turns out that the thrust of the Bible is that it is wrong for someone to have more than they need and use that to oppress other people. It's not just that the poor are accidentally poor. It's that poor poverty, by and large, is because someone is hurting the poor. And so it's not blaming the rich, but I mean, we're talking, the Bible is doing it. The Bible is saying those people who are rich and are using that power and influence to hurt the poor, to keep the poor down, are wrong. And we'll read Isaiah 58 today. There's many, many other texts that say the same thing, that are very clear. It's not just simply that poverty is a bad thing and we ought to correct it. It's that there are people that are responsible for that poverty, and they ought to stop it. It is immoral. It is wrong. So I think those are some of the places where we would be really stupid to just in a knee-jerk kind of a way say, no, free enterprise is bad. We aren't anywhere near, at least in this discussion, being able to conclude anything of the sort. Free enterprise has self-evident, I think, strengths and has produced and been beneficial in some important ways. But there's enough just in terms of the symptoms either laid out here, going all into all the other areas of our life, media, crime, the environment, conflict, and so forth, to suggest that there's some serious problems with our culture, wherever they lie. And as I say, at least in this discussion, we're nowhere near pinpointing, but there are some elements of it, either from the biblical text or from the comparisons with other cultures, to say that yeah, in fact, there are some problems that we need to begin zeroing in on. So, yes?
One other symptom that I don't see here anywhere yet so far.
Good.
That I perceive is that the ever-increasing involvement of government in our lives is a symptom of this whole thing, too. In other words, something's wrong, government should fix it. And I think we need to be very wary about that. And the church should have been in the past and should become much more involved in taking care of the problem issue on a practical level, not just suggesting what the government ought to do or something like that.
But the church doesn't collect taxes.
There are many things that could be done informally in the past that require something more structured, like collecting taxes and paying for it. So I think of examples. I think there's a lot of truth. There's a lot of abusive or stupid or ill-organized, ill-directed, ill-run things by the government. But to be perfectly frank, I've talked with many people that have worked their lives in corporations, and I've worked in a few. I saw some equally stupid things in corporations. I've worked for years in universities. They did some really outrageously dumb things too. I mean, I think large entities are as much the source of that conflict or that problem as that the government is bad versus corporation. Give it to the private sector, they'll do it better. So there's not an easy kind of a thing there. I think there's some very sloppy kind of thinking by some politicians in simply targeting the government. And in fact, I strongly suspect that the government is being made a scapegoat by people who are benefiting from a system that does not tax them at all. I talked to one of the people here at Holden now is a city planner in on the east side of Washington in the area where Bill Gates lives, and reported, I never even saw this before, that Bill Gates was able to get the state government to pass a rule that he does not have to pay the taxes to his municipality, millions of dollars, he personally, from his wealth and his enterprise. And that's the sort of thing that business is able to use government for its own ends. A lot of the problems in government is that it is the part of our government that isn't democratic, or isn't as democratic as the rest of it is. That is, it's places where people with power use government to increase their power, or to reduced their contribution to society. So even some of the problems with government have their source, being doctors here, right? We're tracing that symptom. It may look like it's a cold. It has its source in some other place, and it may be a more serious thing, like a pneumonia of people that are rich. And it, again, I'm not criticizing an individual who is rich. There are many very, very moral rich people. I've known some. But I'm rather saying that power frequently spends part of its resource in retaining or strengthening or enhancing its own power. And that's the way power operates. And there's some outrageous ways that that's occurred in our society, far in excess of the ways in which I've heard government criticized. Or to look at it a little differently from a more practical point of view, there was a time in the United States where if you built a new house or had a business and was expanding it and didn't want it to burn down, you would sign up and pay a fee to a private fire company. So that if you had a fire, they would send their truck over or their two little horse-drawn wagons over your fire and put out your fire. And if it happened that one of their other clients had a fire an hour earlier in another part of the town, you could be out of luck. And it didn't take long in densely packed areas, in particular in cities, for people to conclude that that wasn't a very smart way of doing business. That it would be better if we socialized fire protection. We use socialism, by some people's definition. That is, we, as a society, took on the issue of fire protection, taxed everybody, and had fire stations evenly distributed throughout the community so that they would be close to every single person who might need that service. And so that if one fire station had two fires, you'd connect them with networks of communication and so forth and bring in the resources. How many of you would like to go back to private fire companies? Government doesn't know how to do anything. Let's have private enterprise do what government can't do. I mean, it's obvious that there are two sides to the question of whether government ought to do a particular function. I personally believe that it's outrageous that we have healthcare run the way we do in this country. We spend more, and by most standards, get less than most of the rest of the industrialized world. We have much higher infant mortality rate, much higher maternal mortality rates, enormously higher numbers of people that don't get inoculations and other kinds of services. And people will claim we have the best medicine in the world, you've got to ask who's getting it, because it isn't the majority of the public. The majority of the public does not have access to the best medicine in the world. We have the best medicine in the world for the people in whose interest we have the kind of system we've got. So the issue of government is an important one. As someone who labors under stupid rules and forms, I am entirely empathetic for streamlining government or getting government out of things it doesn't do well or whatever else. But it's become a whipping boy or a scapegoat for some functions that use a different term than government. Do we want socially to handle a particular function? And is it something where if we collected tax dollars and so forth, it would work better? And that puts the discussion more in kind of neutral ground, less sort of emotionally charged on either side. And then let's just look at it and figure out what's the best way to do it. But an awful lot of government, to be perfectly frank, is in the pocket of the industries that they're supposed to be regulating, or at the behest of the most powerful organizations or corporations or whatever in the state. Talk to any member of the state legislature in Washington. The power of Weyerhaeuser or Boeing or Microsoft compared to the power of anything else in the state. And they'll tell you, they'll laugh, in fact. So
how can you then, at the grassroots level of our country, move to balance power so that both the elderly who live longer will get care?
Right.
They are living longer now.
Right.
And we are told that the poor are increasing in number. But we're tackling a little bit of it by the fact that you can't be on welfare for more than 2 or 5 years. You better get out there and earn some money.
I would like to, if I could have one law, my law would be nobody in any state legislature or in Congress gets to vote on any piece of welfare legislation of any kind without spending at least 2 weeks following around a couple average welfare recipients. Just look at what their day is like. Two members of the state legislature in California, one Democrat, one Republican, agreed to live on food stamps for 1 month and to visit 1 or 2 days a week, visit the sites of the experience of poor people in their state. And when they were done, they said, this is unbelievable. You can't live on that amount of money. People were whining about the minimum wage going up. The minimum wage when Nixon was president, if you adjust it for inflation, is $7.20 an hour. It was just raised to $5.10 an hour. Now, there is a legitimate debate about whether the minimum wage is the right way to make sure that nobody starves or is too poor in a country. You know, there's a minimum that any society wants to have. You can't get poorer than this or we'll help. But Nixon is not widely regarded as a raving liberal. And if $7.20 an hour was okay when Nixon was president, $5.10 an hour just might not be enough.
But then we go back to, it's the company that has to pick up, has to raise this wage for these people. And then in turn, it's the general public that comes back and pays that.
Right. I personally would be delighted to pay that in 2 cents more for a toaster or 10 cents more for whatever, you know. And I think many people would. I mean, it's amazing the goodness that's left in this country when a problem is presented to the American public. The American public, I think, is capable of, if it was given the option to say, would you like to spend twice as much money on Head Start and WIC and a few other programs to make sure that no child doesn't get enough nutrition, right? Because the facts are that you're going to spend 3 or 4 or 6 or 10 times as much money as you would pay for those programs in health costs, in prison rates, in other kinds of functions later. Just purely financially, purely on the money level, we would be better off to just give everybody who needs those services that those kinds of monies. And yet you have people that are really lying to us, saying we need to cut those sorts of services because we're spending too much on it. And it's just preposterous. There isn't a European country that wouldn't be humiliated at what we spend on these kinds of services. There's a chart in this book, and this is not, this is a fairly mainstream publication, if you will. Toward the end of the book, there's a chart that shows how much we actually spend compared to our trading partners, you know, the other industrialized nations, page 68. And we spend a little less than some, we spend a little more than others. And then it shows, we spend less than most of them, but we're not at the absolute bottom of the list. Then it shows the percentage of people that are in poverty in each of the countries, and there we're almost at the top. We have more people in poverty than almost any other industrialized nation. But that's not the worst of it. I mean, that's bad enough. The really embarrassing part of this graph is the black line, the dark line, and that's the line of the people who are still in poverty after all of the governmental programs. Now, again, I could imagine a society where you wouldn't have any welfare at all, where everything would be handled through at the grassroots level. Congregations would just take charge of every poor person in town, and you'd give them the kind of one-to-one support and aid and so forth. I mean, that very conservative idea is actually appealing to me. But until we get to that, or unless we make a commitment to go that kind of a route, where you take responsibility for all poor people, which is how I read the gospel. Yeah. It's embarrassing that most of the rest of the countries of the world that are anywhere near the kind of income levels, and some of them half as wealthy as we are, like Spain or Italy or whatever, are doing vastly better, significantly better than we are in the result. And that is how many people are still poor. And they can't have that many fewer people that are trying to get a free ride on welfare. I mean, that really, I don't think, is the answer.
What is their secret?
What's that?
What is their secret?
Glenn?
Yeah.
Isn't it that they don't have a defense budget?
Part of it is that they don't spend as much in some other areas as we do. But much of it is that they have...
Their taxes are very high.
But not vastly more. I mean,
Sweden is 50%.
Well, if you add all of our taxes together, we're not so very far away from that.
And Germany is quite high.
Yeah, they're higher than ours. But most, I think, if we were able to just debate dispassionately, lay out, this is what you would get if you pay this much more in taxes, I'd wager that a sizable percentage of the American public would be willing to raise their taxes. If we could reduce the crime on our streets, reduce the poverty, reduce the number, I mean, the business people downtown are constantly complaining about homeless people peeing in front of their store at night.
But I don't want my taxes raised when I look at television media that tells me that the government is spending billions of dollars for a lousy highway around Boston. Did you receive that one?
I've heard about that. I mean,
that was a boondoggle that I have ever...
Our priorities are really, really wacky sometimes. I mean, and as I say in the fact sheet that was at the door, I mean, one of the problems, you mentioned the defense budget. We use a yardstick to measure defense spending and an inch stick to measure social spending. I mean, there have been polls done, and I report one of them in the file there about international aid. People believe we spend 20 or 30 or 60 or 100 times as much in foreign aid as we really do, and believe that we spend more than any other country, which is absolutely wrong. We're at the bottom in per capita spending in foreign aid. And the same is true in welfare. Significantly less than most of our trading partners, and are getting less out of it, and we have symptoms, we have problems that are really dragging the economy down. There are business people that are totally on the side of the point of view that I'm putting forth here, because they think that it's stupid not to spend a little money in order to solve a problem. A stitch in time is kind of a smart way to approach life. So it's not a liberal conservative kind of a thing even. It's, do we want to put a little more resource into something that will pay off? Why is it that we have such a high criminal population? You know, and part of it, I think, increasingly, it's not the whole answer. It's not reducible to this, but certainly part of it is that we have this kind of long-term poverty that we have in our country. I've lived in the poorest areas of New York City and Oakland for 16 years. I mean, I don't know everything about it, but I know poor people. I know welfare cheats, but I also know that the vast majority of people on welfare are not. They're single parents, or they're elderly people, or they're disabled people, or whatever. We have a feeding program at our church for homeless people, mostly. It's open to anybody, but most of the people are transparently poor. And it was designed for 100 people maximum, 60 people on an average. We have 150 people on average. It's been over 250 a number of times lately. I hang out with them. I help serve a couple times a week. And most of these people, if we followed them around for that 2-week period that I described, we would agree they probably ought to get welfare. It would be nice if there would be some other things that would happen, but here's a person that has got psychological problems or other kinds of problems that needs help. And now on top of that, if we can get some other social services or other kinds of things in it, it would be great. But we're tackling a range of very, very complex problems here. I feel a little bit like we're sort of bumbling along here as well. Yeah. I feel a little we maybe bit off more than we can accomplish in one session, but I applaud your hanging in there, because there's some very, very important debates and issues involved here, and it's a challenge to try to figure out how to respond to it. So.
20% of the world's population consumes 80% of its goods. Yeah. What can I do to reverse that?
There's an organization called Alternatives. just to pick one example, that provide itself is a whole resource center for simplifying our living. That would be one. I think tomorrow night's forum on the media, the average person sees 1,400 or 1,600 ads per day of one kind or another. I mean, we are so saturated, so barraged with enticements to spend more, to consume more, and so forth. Somewhere in that, and again, it's like our discussion here, I want to step back and not assume that I know the answer to it, but somewhere in that, there's something off, right? There's something that isn't going to produce the best result if that's the way you've organized what gives you information on what you ought to buy and how much money you need to earn and what kind of lifestyle you ought to have. I mean, I taught fifth grade, and I watched little fads and consuming patterns just sweep through. One kid would bring it, they were a leader, everybody else had to have it, and so forth. I mean, those sorts of phenomena, and we ought to be observing those sorts of phenomena in a variety of areas of life and try to come to some conclusions about where the problem is. And it takes patience, and it takes one of the most rare commodities in our culture is being willing to step back and try to ignore your assumptions and look at things fresh and try to figure out where the issues are. And just like that doctor, if he or she is any good, it's not going to necessarily be the first thing you think of. You've got to perform tests, you've got to examine, you have to explore and withhold judgment or be willing to reverse your assumptions to come up with a conclusion that's really going to work. And on that note, I'll be happy to stay for a couple minutes afterwards. There are a variety of resources on the tables back here for if anybody wants to pursue any of this further. But why don't we end with a song, a hymn, and it's the half page that was just passed out. Want to just play through it once and then we'll send the second time around.